Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello, I'm Kellyanne Taylor, and this is the Radio Times podcast. Every week, I sit down with a celebrity guest from the world of TV or film to talk about their lives, both on and off screen. To my fellow TV enthusiasts, I hope you enjoy listening. This week, I am joined by two very special guests. Pop star turned actor Lily Allen, and appearing on the podcast for a second time is the wonderful Mikita Oliver. They both grew up in Ladbroke Grove, West London, in creative households, spending much of their youth roaming Portobello Market and flunking school. Lily's mother is the film producer Alison Owen, and her father is the actor Keith Allen. Mikita was raised by her mother, the broadcaster and chef Andy Oliver. Both Oliver and Allen made their name at a young age. Mikita as a TV presenter on Channel 4's music show Pop World, and Lily for her debut smash hit Smile. In this episode, they talk about the perils of fame and how they handle trolls. Plus, they reminisce about the hedonism of the noughties and reveal why they never listen to the advice imparted by their famous family members. Lily Allen, and for the second time, Mikita Oliver, welcome to the Radio Times podcast.
Thank you. Hi. You said I'm the second guest ever.
You're the first guest ever.
I mean, yes, first guest. Twice. That's it.
Which is mega.
Yeah.
But I thought I couldn't miss this opportunity. So we're going to start with, what is the view from your sofa? Mikita, I think it'll be the same as last time, but remind guests.
It's quite a lot of magical artifacts. My telly right there. And then I have a sideboard that I got made because all sideboards, I hate it. They all looked really like 70s and kitsch. And I wanted something very sleek. So I got a really nice white one made and it fit perfectly. And then I've got a lot of candles and kind of books that my family have given me, like Goodnight Moon and a Maya Angelou, John Michel Basquiat book called Life Doesn't Frighten Me. and then to the right, I can see the water and there are always a lot of birds flying around. So I really like to watch TV and also be able to see outside. I don't like TVs that are just on a wall.
Agreed.
I need to know what's happening in the world around me watching TV.
And I loved last time you said that was like the metaphor of like looking down. It was the first time that you've had a higher up.
Yes,
flat.
Yes, not the first time, but I had a blip where I didn't live high up and my life was in the gutter, so I will never do it again.
Okay.
Living high up is important to me, but she's just bought a flat that's a hell of a lot higher up than mine, so I might just hang out there. And
why
her.
Not? Yeah. Why not? Okay, well, what's the view from your sofa /bed? Where have you watched telly?
It's just leopard print sofa, looking at a big TV, leopard print carpet, and a picture of Diego Maradona on the wall. That's it.
That's my art.
It's kind of minimalist, but also maximalist.
It's quite soft, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Which is quite Lily.
That's nice. Okay, if you two watch TV together, or okay, if you were to watch TV together, who would get control of the remote? Or do you have similar taste?
No, we don't have similar taste. I think she'd probably get control of the remote, but she likes things that are a lot darker. She doesn't mind crime and murder, and I don't like that stuff.
I don't know if we've ever
watched
TV together.
Come on.
Maybe we might, like, back in the day when we cared, we might watch the Brit Awards together.
No. We did have a Hills period. Come on.
We did?
Yes, in Queen's Park flat.
We watched The Faculty.
Oh, yeah. No, when we were kids, we used to watch a lot of films together. Yeah.
Okay.
And that was The Faculty for Josh Hartnett.
When we say a lot of films, we mean the same film over and over again.
But that's the sign of true friendship.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
You've got like a combined show. I used to watch like the Mary-Kate and Ashley, their like children's films.
Terrible,
yeah,
TV films.
That
Come
was
on.
Like my entire childhood, the same ones again and again. And you know what's going to happen. So
yeah,
why are
course,
you watching?
Of course.
My lips are sealed.
We knew all the words like before. It was like, get a fucking eye out.
Yeah, no, your conspiracy theory is flawed. Yeah, we would just talk it to each other. And still occasionally, I'll text her a line from The Faculty.
yeah. just to keep it alive.
To make sure the flame's still there.
Okay, how did you two meet? Or we talk met, me through?
Our parents are best friends, and so Makita was 1 year old when I was born, and she met me.
I suppose I did meet you, but I don't remember meeting Lily because we were babies. So that's really funny. That's not a question we've ever been asked because... or had to think about because we've never met.
Yeah,
that just, makes sense.
We just were.
Always know.
Just always have been.
There.
Exactly.
Okay, so parents, best friends. So Andy and your
My mum, Alison.
Mom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was childhood like? Talk me through memories, shared memories.
Blocked out. traumatized.
I would say chaotic. Full of a lot of different people and a lot of, there were a lot of different people raising us all. All of our mum's friends would also become our aunties and uncles, like Danny and Judy for you, Nana and Cameron for me. And it was a kind of a free for all.
I suppose if you were looking for an adjective, you would say it was quite bohemian.
Yeah.
Well, I hate that word, but you know, parents and all our families are, you know, work in the creative industries. There were lots of artists and writers and musicians and cooks and, you know, it was very, there weren't many hedge funders.
No. No one for business.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. But like, you know, I think being kids in that, luckily there were a lot of kids. Everyone at that time sort of had kids. So we've got a lot of cousins that are all the same age. And I think that kind of, I don't know, we sort of looked after each other, and that's why we're all still so close, the kind of the kids.
And also, our parents used to hang out in this one particular restaurant back in the day called 192, and there's not enough space for the kids, so we would just be sort of left outside to like roam Portobello Market, and, you know, yeah, we'd just sort of go shoplifting.
So. No, come on! Yeah, maybe the body shop a few times got hit up.
But that sounds so fun. But then it's also, I think even doing like my job or working even in remote creative fields, you're constantly worried about like stability, like there's loads of redundancies in journalism at the moment, things like that, or like writing, you know, writing full time. You're thinking like, how am I going to make money? How am I going to make ends meet? And your mum, last time she was on the podcast, one of my favourite women of all time. Oh. Sorry, I'm so obsessed with her.
Oh.
I'm so obsessed with that woman. But she was saying, for you guys growing up, she'd make, you know, these massive meals, but it'd be like chicken wings that she bought down the shops for £5, yeah. And the whole meal would be like that. Did it ever feel like there wasn't enough, or did it feel like the creativity kind of sustained?
I think that there was much more of a sense of actual community back mm-hmm. in those days. And so I think that what I really sort of garnered from our childhood is that quite often, you know, like different families would be sort of not in a particularly good position financially, but then another family would sort of step in and help. And it would be the same thing with childcare. Like my mom obviously didn't have enough money for, you know, to have like nannies and stuff for us when we were really little, but godparents would always step in, and you know, meals were provided, and yeah. people would be there to help with homework. And it was very much like it took a village.
Yes.
and it really did feel like that.
I think that's really important. Like it was that's what I meant by a lot of people brought us up. It was actually a really beautiful thing. But I think there's a misconception that Lily was a rich kid, and she really wasn't. Alison worked really hard, and they really didn't have anything when Lily was a kid. And I think there was quite a lot of fear of like mum's skin, and you know, but then things would change, and my mum would get a job, and then Alison would get a job, and then all the money would go again, and then they would get, it was just quite up and down and all yeah. over the place.
It's so true, but I think that's also a misconception of people who live in London or like a central London. You know, if somebody says, oh, you know, Lillianne grew up near Portobello Market,
yeah.
they don't necessarily understand that that isn't...
No, it was in 1985.
Yeah, in my housing trust flat. So, like, it's not a thing. It wasn't, like, a thing.
Yeah, which is actually mad. And people don't necessarily know, like, the story of you, or even if they know, like, who your parents are or whatever.
But that's
it's very easy to judge.
Yeah, but that's the great thing about London, and West London's no different. It's like, we were all being brought up, basically, in my mum's housing trust flat, but Lily's godparents down the road had a beautiful townhouse, and I had aunties and uncles with nice townhouses down the road, and then we had our friends in the estates. Like, that's why we're from Ladbroke Grove, because we're from every single part of it and what that really means, and not just like we're from the edgy bit or we're from the rich bit. It's all of it that raised us. I think the other parent of our childhood was Ladbroke Grove and yeah. and our area and all the things that are like in that.
Did you go to the same school?
Sometimes. When she followed me.
Also, I used to like bunk off of my school and go to their school sometimes.
Yes.
Like, I didn't even go there, but I went anyway.
No, no. For real. One time, we both did not do well in school. So we both went to, respectively, I think 6 or 7 each.
And the rest.
And this is, that's a lot.
That's a lot of school.
And then by the time I was like 14, I started at this weird school in Queensway. And one day I went to class and they were like, and this is our new student, Lily. And I was like, the fuck are you doing here? And she was like, I've just started. I think we both were running out of school.
Yeah,
and
basically there was like the been one chucked left. Out of so many.
Terrible.
Did you do all right there? Look at us. Did here you we are at the BBC.
Yeah, you did all right at the BBC. Look, here we are at the BBC telling our story.
But that's the great thing, isn't it? Okay, so where do you start getting the idea that you both want to go into music for you, TV presenting? Does that feel kind of accessible? Does it feel like a route like that you can find into it? Or
to be honest, I don't think I ever really had any aspirations. It was everything was always about survival for me. And I, as I said, didn't leave school with any qualifications. And I didn't, I just, you know, people would like let me go up to Manchester and do studio sessions and work on demos. And I didn't really know if it was going anywhere, but I was like 17, 18 at the time. So it didn't, you know, I was just trying something out. And then that music happened for me. So
I think when you were like 20, you started getting a bit more like serious about it.
I was like, oh, yeah, there seems to be some money in my bank account.
Yeah,
like,
this seems to be going quite well. I should probably focus on this. But with Pop World, I was only 15, so I had no plan. I was trying to figure out how to do
much. How did you get into it?
That was just a lovely lady who changed my life called Tamsin remembering me from a dinner party a few years earlier and said to my mum, we're looking for a girl for this music show. We've got the boy. How old's Makita? And mum was like 15. They were like, oh, I guess that'll be all right. So obviously not. And then I went to the audition because it meant I could miss school. And then I got it, yeah. But once I did the audition, I think I must have told you, I definitely told some people, I want that. I was like, whatever that was, I want that. And then I got it, and Lily was well pissed off.
It's fair enough.
Then I went and did my own thing. And then she
struck revenge a few years later.
And that's been our whole career
ever since. Yeah,
it was my turn. My go.
Actually. My go. No,
but
actually.
But that's so nice. But it's also when you're making your way and you're that young, that must have been absolutely wild to wrap your head around.
It was in the beginning, being a teenager, 15 to 21, it was just like weird and ridiculous. But once Lily became famous, it became just like this thing that was in our lives. And then with Lily, it became so, everything became so much bigger. It was things like paparazzi stuff that I'd never had to really deal with. Mm. So actually, it became really nice to have a team member or just like someone in the family that understood this ridiculous shit that was happening to our very young lives.
Yeah.
Even more so now that we're grown-ups, I look back and I'm like, God, thank God we had that both. Because it's quite a lonely, weird thing to happen to a life.
And you do see, you hear people talking about it now, if they kind of become famous overnight, you hear them say, like, no one can prepare you for it. No one, there's nothing that you can say.
No, and we came from a family with people that were famous in it, and I still had no fucking clue what
to do. Did they ever give you any advice?
No, actually. No. Honestly, I've never had any advice. I've asked for some advice sometimes from, like, Nana when I was about 21 and it was getting a bit hard. But, I mean, it's the thing about fame is it's very different. Lily had a very different experience to me and I had a very different experience to her, and we continue to.
I remember someone telling me to stop talking so much.
To press or just...
Yeah, like to stop being so sort of, like, revealing in interviews. And
yeah, you were quite open.
But I felt I was really young. It's like, you know, when you're what I imagine it to be like, you know, at the student union at university is like you're opinionated at that age and you have ideas and you want to share them. I just happened to have a microphone stuck in my face and asking me those questions at that time. And so I felt passionate and I felt like actually I have this platform and I do have idea, like strong ideas and opinions about the world and I do want to share them. And how dare you try and restrict me? But they were saying it in a place of, you know, trying to protect me. But I felt like I'm not here. I'm not like a careerist. Like I don't, there's not like some like long longevity, like a huge plan that I'm trying to protect. It was just like, I'm an artist and I want to express myself.
And your music.
So I'm going to express myself.
Yeah. So it's like, why are you allowed to say all of these things through your music, to make social commentary, to talk about what it is to be a woman and then not be able to say it directly?
Well, this is the thing as well. You've got to remember, this is 25 years ago for me and 22 years ago for you beginning. And no one had a brand. It wasn't like thinking, you didn't think about the long-term plan of like career. It was just like, I've got this job, my job, Lily was her job essentially. And we were just both very good at it and very naturally good at what we were both doing. And it was in us. I was just very good at being a TV presenter and she was a bloody great pop star. So, and musician and songwriter. So I think we weren't really thinking about anything because we were children.
Also, I felt quite annoyed because, you know, my mum was, I lived with Harry Enfield for like three or four years when I was a kid. My mum was, you know, his girlfriend, and we moved in with him. And my dad was an actor and was, you know, hanging out in the Groucho Club with, you know, quite famous people. So I had an idea of what it was to be famous and in the public eye, but I was a woman. And so I'd seen both those people be able to express themselves and behave, you know, in quotes, you know, badly or whatever, and get away with it. In fact, be celebrated for it.
Yes, of course.
And so when I got there, I was like, well, hey, you know, I'm gone number one in the charts. I'm going to go and have a drink and celebrate and get photographs smoking cigarettes. And no one ever said to me, like, you can't do that because you're a woman.
Mm.
But that's actually what it was.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that was a bit... a bit gaslighty, really, because people were saying, to me, the way I was interpreting it was like, there's something wrong with you. And actually, there wasn't. It was just that I was a woman.
It just came for
her. Yeah, it's so true. And now we look back on those times. And I mean, I think it was very hedonistic. It was, you know, the kind of late 90s, early noughties.
Oh, wasn't it great? Like, I miss it. So easy back then, yeah.
It looked great. And there was like lots...
We made it look great.
Thank you. To be fair, I grew up, and you guys were my mom used to berate me because I'd get these really cute dresses and I'd always wear them with trainers. And I was like, I'm like Lily.
Yeah, Lily. It's like I'm doing
Lily Allen. To the... like normal people were amazing, and that wasn't, you know, it must have been difficult to make that space as young women constantly being berated by the press, and in an era where it became not only was kind of the lifestyle really hedonistic, but the press, the intrusion was like something that is now, I'm sure today it still happens to some extent, but it felt right.
It's weird when Lily went through with paparazzi and stuff. I don't know. I actually don't think it's that as insane as it was then. It was fucking ridiculous. I think it is if you're like a Kardashian, but this was just like leaving Groucho's and it's like 100 photographers. What?
Well, I think that, you know, the industry changed when social media exploded because celebrities started being able to make their own content, which newspapers then, you know, get it for free rather than having to pay freelancers to chase people around. Mm-hmm. So,
that's so true.
The industry just, the model just changed.
So there's less photographers being paid on the street, so they don't exist in the same way. You know what? I was watching that Netflix One Day show, and obviously Dex becomes the TV presenter and he starts getting like berated. And it's like this fucking tiny little column in like the stupid 3 a.m. type page in The Sun. I'm like, whatever. And I was like, no, that used to be powerful. Yeah. Even that a paragraph on that stupid page was really powerful. I mean, like, we were part of like London Light time. Like, this is when they were just dishing out papers and they needed content for them. So us going
to like when we'd leave the Groucho Club sometimes.
No, fuck off.
We'd know that there were photographers outside and Makita would pick up. There's always like a whole rack of like newspapers and she'd always pick
pick one up to be like, I'm going to look like I just came in here to read the paper. I completely drunk.
She'd be like walking out with a telegraph at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's like, what are you doing?
Like, they were partying. I just came in for a cup of tea and a quick read of the news.
Do you think
didn't fool anyone. Didn't fool anyone, Kellyanne. Considering like the night before I would have like carried Lily out in a bag from a club or something. Not fooling anyone.
And we would walk out and be like, keep stay newspaper.
The worst thing is if you Google us, you can see me with lots of different newspapers under my arm.
Bowling out Groucho's as a copy of Sophie's Choice.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So with the difference in, we see this evolution, so people who are famous now have the access to share their lives through social media, and I guess it cuts that middleman, the press, because you can speak directly to your fans. But then what that also does is that invites every single person with a social media account to weigh in with their opinions and their voice and their thoughts. Mm. Is that worse or better than tabloid intrusion?
Someone said something vile to my mum yesterday on social media, and she doesn't really get that. And I was thinking about it all night and it really upset me. And I suppose, would it be worse if the paper said it? Probably, because you feel like more people are seeing it.
I disagree. They've got less spread now.
I don't mean now. I mean the way it hurt then or how it affects you then. I think it's the same cut. Yeah, I think it cuts in the same way, isn't it?
I think that, people on social media, trolls, have just taken the role of tabloid newspapers now. I think that it's just the people do monstering rather. They used to call it monstering back in the 90s and the noughties.
Is that the
word
they
used? Which is what tabloids used to do to people. Oof. Like, you know, Paul Yates or, you know, whoever's like the...
Such an attack, isn't it? Monstering.
Mm. Yeah, well, they used to monster people and now we call it cancelling, which is the same thing, I think. Can be the same thing.
I'm really sorry about that comment to your mum.
Oh, do you know what I mean? It's like some silly, sad lady who then cooked herself dinner.
I didn't mean it. I was just really annoyed.
No, but it just, for a minute, my mum and I just talked about it. We thought, it's so weird. Like, whoever did it is a person that then walked down the street. And the thing she said was so nasty. And it's like, you definitely just... lay your head down later and be like, could have sent that message.
Do you
message.
Know, can I
like,
tell you what? Something? That me and David, my husband, have a troll that is always on the Daily Mail website, constantly commenting and has been. She's obsessed with David's ex-girlfriend and their relationship and now detests me.
Oh, right.
And we've named our production company after her.
That's what you do. No, that is my level of
because we just can't wait to put something out and her to be like...
this one's for you.
Shit.
But it's not always... you can't always have that mindset. Love. You know, like, it's really easy for me to see, like, a comment online to a celebrity and think, like, that person's insane for writing that. And that's so unkind and who are you? But when you're the person receiving it...
Mm-hmm.
That relationship must be difficult.
But also, it's just like, even doing this project, like, you know, Lily and I have never worked together. Obviously, I've interviewed Lily a lot throughout our careers, but we've never worked together and done something together. And just even doing this, we have the things that Lily says, like, we need to be careful because they all do. It's like, she lives very differently to me with the press because she has a completely different history with them because of the things that have happened in the past. And it's like... I don't think about that enough as her mate. Like, fuck, yeah, it's so serious and it's real and it's part of your life and your history.
But it's silly, isn't it? But I guess.
Yeah, but I do know all of that. So it's also important that I remember how
real
that stuff is.
Well, you know some of it to a certain extent, but I can be quite shut down and isolated. And I think I did carry a lot of it and kept a lot of it to myself. The sort of inner workings, like I would have a dialogue with like my lawyers and sometimes my managers and my press officer. But I, you know, it's funny, isn't it? It's like I'd go to lunch at my family's on a Sunday and people would be like, how are you doing? And I would never say like,
this
I'm
was hell
utterly
today.
Devastated. Yeah. Like my whole life has been, you know, splashed all out on the Sunday papers for everyone to see, but it's okay because I'm suing them and I'm getting a retraction and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, all that detail.
It doesn't necessarily take the words away. Like when they've been there, they've caused the damage, and I think it's a shame that, I mean, obviously it's nice to have some kind of.
I actually, but in the noughties when it was like really rife, I used to. There were three different charities, so literally every week I would sue them, get a retraction, they'd have to pay me a certain amount of money, and it would just go straight to charity. So in my head, it was quite nice. I was like, every time they said something really bad that was plainly untrue, a charity was going to make 20 grand out of it. So
you sort of reframed it completely, yeah. Turned it into something else, but you can't always do that. But
no.
I think it's important to try and take some sort of control over it.
When you're experiencing this, you're dealing with this, and Miki, last time you were on the podcast, you spoke about the bankruptcy and having to go through that incredibly mm-hmm. publicly and having to take a step back from your career.
Yeah.
So that was for you a rock bottom. How did you get your career back on track? Or I say back on track, which I detest because...
No, it's very, very, very... important to, because it wasn't easy, and it was the two attempts. The first attempt was just after that, and I hadn't really learned everything I was meant to learn from that experience. I was just like, oh, I need to get back on screen. And so I started training with Mackenzie every day, and I got V Festival, and I was like, I'm back. But I hadn't fixed my life, and I hadn't sorted things out, so I hadn't really got anything back. I was just working again, but I was still very, very low. And then it took like another 3 or 4 years. I don't know, it just felt like the stars were a bit aligned with everything I'd learned and everything I'd been through. And I also was sick of not working, and I really enjoy my job and I love my career and it's really important to me. And I hadn't really thought about it like that before. It was more like, I need to get back on screen to make a point that I'm not on screen. Suddenly I was like, I just want to work again because I love it and it fills up my soul. And then it all just started happening again. But I worked really fucking hard and had to be strategical and say no to things and not say yes just because it was a job on something. I would do things and then go, that's enough of that. We need to move on and keep moving up. And I had to, really fight through a lot. It's not been easy, but I've had a really, it's been lovely to just, work on all these different things again that I am creating myself with Mum, and also now doing this with Lil. I never thought we'd be doing anything like this. And it just feels like when we were away in Africa for Christmas together, and I said to Lily, what do you want to do next? And you said, I just kind of just do whatever I fancy and what feels right in that moment. Mm. And I'm always very plan, strategic, da da da. And I've really listened to that about what Lily said. And I've been thinking about it with this year. And I feel that that's a really, we're lucky that we can feel like that. And we're just doing things that feel good.
Mm.
There's no reason, there's no other reason that we're doing this podcast other than it just feels really good to do something together at this time in our lives. It wouldn't have been right before, but it just came up and it feels quite exciting.
Yeah. And Lily, what about you? You're now acting, Sam, producer Sam, saw you in The Pillow Man.
I'm sorry.
shut up. Yeah. She was amazing. No, she knows it. Don't worry, Sam.
Take ownership of how amazing you are in that. What about you? Where did the acting come from? You say you didn't have a plan.
I really didn't. I mean, I was in quite not recent sobriety. I think I was about 2 years sober, and I just moved to New York. And, big part of sobriety is sort of surrendering and sort of letting, God in the way in which, whatever way you want to believe in that, that has a plan for you. And I got a call out of the blue from a casting director who said, we're putting together this play in the West End in London in September. Would you be up for it?
Wasn't it July?
Yeah, sorry, in the summer. And I was like, well, no, because I'm not an actress. And also I've just moved to New York. So that would be a no. And then that night I went home to David, and I was really upset about something in that period of time. I was sort of feeling a bit rudderless and a bit sort of directionless and didn't really know what I was going to be doing with my life except for being a mom in Brooklyn and setting up a new home. And he'd sort of said, what happened today? And I said, well, actually, I got this weird call from a casting director about a play in London. And he was like, well, what's the play about? And I said, I didn't ask. I just said, no, thanks. And he was like, don't you think maybe you should call them back and see what that's about? And I was like, yeah, maybe I should. So I did. And then they sent me the script, and I liked the script and got David to read it because I didn't really trust my own instincts. And he was like, no, I think it's good. And I think you'll be able to bring something to that part. And then I said yes, and 5 weeks later, yeah. I was in rehearsals.
Was that for 222?
That was for 222.
But that was intense. The rehearsal period of that, I've never known Lily to be so scared or nervous because it was never really like that with singing. But there was no question that she wasn't going to do it. Mm. She was just very scared and nervous, but it was just part of the adrenaline of it.
Yeah.
But we were a bit like, the fuck are you doing? I can't believe you have to go on the Western stage. And actually, from all the many, many gigs I've gone to Lily's, that was terrifying, watching her do the first night.
But I sort of felt like, you know, there was like, it was the right thing to do. It felt dangerous in a way that was exciting to me. And I've always felt like that. I like the stakes to be high. I like the stakes to be really high. It makes me feel alive. I like sort of jumping off a cliff and being like into the unknown.
Into the abyss. And I wondered when I was kind of thinking about the theatre thing, if that gives you the same rush or feeling as it does kind of being on stage musically performing to it.
Do you know what? It's actually not really so much like the rush of performing on stage singing musically. It's more akin to the rush of being in the studio and writing a song.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's more the telling a story from start to finish. So when you feel like you've hit it and you've delivered on that story, the thing that I've experienced in life that's the most similar would be writing a coherent pop song, 3.5 minutes.
When you write a song,
yes.
Do you know instantly, okay, this is going to be a good one? Or is it more the feeling of I've got across what I needed to?
I love that question.
No, it's sort of like, this is an interesting idea, yeah. And then you kind of get through it and you're like, oh, this kind of works with that chorus. Yeah, this could be good. And then you do the second verse and you're like, this is a song. It's going there. And then, yeah, sort of. I think early on in my career when I would write, if I didn't feel that feeling of like, I think this is good, then I probably wouldn't finish it. If a song gets finished for me, it generally means that I think it's good. Yeah.
Interesting. Thank you for asking that, because I'm always asking her like about her creative process. I'm like, but like, how do you like write a song? Yeah. And we were trying to figure out, I was like, what's the difference between a bridge and the middle eight?
Oh.
I don't think we can answer.
I don't think I can answer that. But you know what's really interesting is I listened to my second album, It's Not Me, It's You, the other day.
Yeah.
And not one song on that record has any lyrics in the middle eight.
Not even a la 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 la.
No, maybe it will have like, it has like instrumental middle eights, but most like, you know, pop songs, modern pop songs will have verse, chorus, middle eight, chorus.
Yeah, that's
and they'll each be their own, you know, set of lyrics. And not one of those
lazy
11
bitch.
Songs, I think, has any lyrics in the middle eight.
Oh, we were very, I was just like, this is brilliant. Let's move on. I was going to say, that was quite the energy of that year. Yeah. Very like, absolutely brilliant, let's go, let's move on. Go.
Greg would be like, let's do one. I'm like,
no,
needed, it's fine.
But do you think that's also a confidence of youth a little bit?
Well, I remember when The Fear came out, so this is when the video came out, so we've been talking about it like sort of 6 months before. It was her birthday, her 23rd at Alison's, at her mum's. Yes, yeah, so young. And also, difficult second album. And I was really worried that she was going to be really nervous and freaked out. And she was quite the opposite.
I was like, I got this.
She turned up in her mock.
I'll tell you.
Because we realised that I remember everything in our history from what we were wearing. I'll tell you what we were wearing. The Marc Jacobs, like, cartoony blue dress, like, pencil dress.
Oh, what, with the noddies?
Yes.
That wasn't Marc Jacobs, that was vintage. I still got that dress.
Okay,
yes.
There you go. So you were wearing that, and you had fear hair, so fringe, straight long black hair. And she was just playing The Fear over and over and going, how good is this? And bringing people into the room. I was like, I think she'll be fine. But then the album was a huge hit. a bigger hit than the first, actually. So I think if your second album is a bigger hit than your first, you really, it's really hard to not become a bit of an arsehole for just a moment.
Hang on.
For just a moment.
Hang on.
Just a moment.
Just a 1 minute.
Just a little world tour moment. That's when life became absolutely fucking ridiculous, is what I mean. Yeah. So it's quite hard to stay grounded in any way. I don't, Lily was not an arsehole to me or anyone in particular. She just went a bit off with the fairies because it was all ridiculous.
Yeah, because it takes you.
She was just gone. I don't remember that period of time.
She was like gone. Like because no one saw her for like 2 years.
Just traumatized by it, I think. Mm. Yeah.
It was just press, press, no day off, promo, tour, perform and perform.
And then, you know, drinking to sort of recover from it all. Mm. And then, yeah, just absolute exhaustion. And I think the constant commentary and how painful all of that was, I just had to separate myself. And so I think I literally was disassociated from myself. And I really just don't remember it.
Mm. It's so interesting. I read your autobiography and it was a few years ago. And there are some scenes from it. I literally must have read it when it came out. I think I got it for a Christmas present or something. And there are moments, and we won't go there, but that I can recall that I think, like, how on earth does someone move through that? And, like, how awful that, A, that happened to you. I'm really sorry. But, B, like, the coverage of it and talking about it, and especially things involving the police and just the frustration, especially as a young woman. And we've seen, you know, what's happened since then with what's happening with male violence against women and very public cases of that. When you went to write that book, did that feel cathartic? Did that feel like a way to get it out, or what did you want to do with the book?
It felt essential, actually, because I think at that time I was so isolated from my friends, family, and my marriage had broken down, and it felt like the only vehicle of expressing myself. Mm. I had completely cut myself off from everybody. My trust issues were just, I didn't want to talk to anybody because I did not trust anybody. Mm. My paranoia levels were off the scale, and it was the only place that I could put things was into that book. So yeah, catharsis is one word for it, but it was essential for me to do that.
But I think with certain things in the book, I think probably what you're talking about, just the things that Lily went through, particularly with the police, I don't know, I think we still, as friends and family, still go, fuck, can't believe you went through that.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, yeah. It's still shocking and still comes up, and no one can really believe that Lily went through it, because, again, Lil just went through it. She didn't ask for help and say, I need to talk about this. She just went through it like she does. But it's horrible to know that someone you love that much had to go through any of that.
And the weird thing about that whole scenario as well was that, you know, I was going through this whole situation with the stalker and the complicated stuff with the police, and there was lots of paranoia. Some of it was real and some of it wasn't. But it felt to me that because the newspapers weren't covering it, no one believed me that it was real and that it was happening. So it was...
What, you mean like us in your life?
Everyone, yeah. It was like, I would say, somebody broke into my house and tried to murder me, and everyone would be like, you're Lily Allen, and we haven't read about that in the papers. So obviously that's not true and you've gone mad. And so I just shut down. I was just like, I'm not going to talk about this because no one believes me, because they haven't read about it.
And because it was such a truly real thing that culminated in something horrendous and real, it's like double hell for Lily having to feel that she's going mad. That's what really upset me when I found out how much she'd kept to herself. Because I know, that, you know what it's like to be a young woman in London.
Oh, God, yeah.
And to feel targeted and in fear in that way. It's just, I wouldn't want anyone that I love to go through that.
And I think it's really difficult to explain to people when that innate fear and that trust that you have in your gut as a woman, or anyone who is a minority, I think also feels it, that fear, that intrinsic fear of other people around you. And there is something deep within you deep within myself that I will always trust. If I don't feel safe in a situation, or if I get that like sixth sense, I think we're conditioned to be like that as an act of survival.
I thought about that the other day when I was walking down my road. I thought, I did that, and I thought, God, it's like a feral thing as a woman. You're just like, you always kind of do have eyes in the back of your head.
Absolutely.
You always fucking, you have to. And I think that...
And I think, but I think people from the outside, when people are famous, think you'll be protected by these, you know, 24-hour security guards because you're famous. And, like, who could let Lilianne go to Tesco's by herself?
Who could
let Nikki Jorova do this, do that?
I used to think being famous would keep me safe from things like certain things that happen, the awful things that happen all the time. It's just bollocks.
No.
Total bollocks.
Look, I want to come on to talk about the podcast.
Yes! Yeah.
We've talked enough. That's the, thank you.
Thank you very much. I love the idea. So it's going to be you two.
You tell us, what's the idea?
The idea is that you're chatting every week about different things. So rental crisis in London was one that I thought, I've got some strong opinions on that. My friend's having to move out of her flat because they've upped the rent by £500 a month.
And yeah, that's just happened to my friend. He's had to move back home to Brighton. Unbelievable. And he's only been there a year. Unbelievable.
It's insane. So you two are going to be chatting. So you're going to be in America. You're going to be in London. You two have had a great friendship throughout your lives, but you're now living completely different lives, different countries. You've got children.
Do I? Oh, yes, I do.
What keeps you bonded? Why did you want to do this project? And what do you want to explore with your relationship?
I think that for me, that's the interesting part, is what happens when a friendship is from birth and it is alongside each other for our whole lives. But then, you know, then it wasn't at times, and then it's come back. And then, but what's never changed is the way we feel about each other and the bond that we have and the way we relate to each other and the way we are with each other. And I think that's quite interesting, considering life has taken us in all these crazy different places. And the fact that right now, Lily's in a completely different country, and she's with my niece and my goddaughter and her husband, and I don't have kids, and I live in London. But there's this bond of history and root that is just that shit. Just actually, it's not even like that shit never goes. It's vital to even continuing to live that I have this with her.
Also, I think in terms of like what exists in the market, there are lots of podcasts where, you know, there are friends talking, but those relationships feel maybe, I don't want to say forced, but like maybe not as natural.
Yeah.
And I think that what I hope that people will like is that they'll be able to hear that there is a dialogue and a language that we use with each other that will be nostalgic, because people have those friendships all over the world with each other. So I think that people will hear what we have, and they'll be like, this is nice, because this is what I have with my best friend.
Yeah, the truth just sounds different. You know it, everyone in this room does, the way you talk to your brethren, your proper old school friend, is different to how you would talk to the people that have been in your life for maybe 4 or 5 years. So
we can tell each other to shut up.
Yeah, exactly. The whole podcast was just us telling each other to shut the fuck up. But that's why, oh my God, we've been trying to name this podcast for months.
Should have been shut the fuck up.
Can you just stop? No, but I think Miss Me, I really like, because I do really miss her. And I do say it to her a lot. Miss Me? And I think there is that thing of like, in a friendship, I think no matter how long you've known each other, you kind of worry that it won't be the same. And the deep ones always are. They just always are. Nothing changes. We're still like the 6-year-olds when we fucking met. Like, I'm sorry, we met at birth, but like, this is not much has changed in our dynamic relationship wise.
You definitely have a great energy, and it's very nicely done. I do wonder though, you know, you said when you were recording, you might have to be like slightly hesitant about discussing certain things or having opinions on whatever. Podcasts are like by nature much more intimate than, it's a bit like radio. There's an intimacy, people can listen to it when they want, where they want, and you're in their head. So it's a very like isolated thing. Is there any apprehensions about kind of opening up your opinions? Or do you feel like now is the time just to allow yourself to say what you want?
Oh, that's so interesting.
I think for me, it's all about like how much you listen to the noise, right, that comes back. And I just feel like, you know, it will become quite clear quite quickly how much of it I can stomach and how far we can go. And we'll move forward on that basis.
Yeah, also, there's no point in doing it if we're not going to tell the truth. It's just going to be a waste of time. I don't really know. as a broadcaster, I hate being half myself or half opinionated. And I've done my time. And I think it's quite clear that that's how I present things from a very honest place. And I like to tell the truth. And when I listen to podcasts or anything, or I watch TV or anything, I need it to be the truth. I can see through bullshit and I'm not interested. Yeah. So we would not be interested in doing that either. It's just...
But equally, we're not going to like go off. It's not going to be like, hi, welcome to Miss Me this week, Israel.
No, but what I mean is...
Should we talk about trans ideology?
What I mean more like... If she's fucked me off, I'm not going to be like, okay, I'm going to say we had a fight yesterday. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
I'm going to use this as therapy for me and Lil. She doesn't know that yet.
Do you think that as women, we do still have to self-censor? Or especially when you're in the limelight? Do you think we have to more so than men?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we have to. I just think that we do.
Yes.
Because I still think that women are judged, you know, in a harsher way than men are. And, you know, if you look on the, like, for instance, the Daily Mail website, just as an experiment, go on there and look at articles with women and the adjectives that are used, like, straight after their names, compared to the adjectives that are used straight after a man's name, you can see quite clearly how... I mean, I know that's only one publication, but it is quite a big, quite a successful one.
But and also that language is powerful, and it sets a tone, and it sets a precedent, and it sets a culture.
Mm.
And I actually, Lily did do that to me once. She was like, read that and then read that. And it was just like, it's just celebratory, defamatory. Just like that simple.
And women are always like, presented as revealing something, or like being spunky, or like going too far, or like not leaving enough to the imagination. It's just like, and then men are like out there, you know, celebrating their wins.
Yeah. Or like, so, you know, being dapper in the corner and mysterious.
Or like protectively looking after their children.
That. But has that ever impacted your behaviour? Like, have you? it's so true, though, isn't it? And you see it. And also, even from the outside perspective, looking at those things, those words have an impact on every other.
Leaves nothing to the imagination thing really gets me, because it's like, why is it my responsibility to take care of your imagination? I'm not letting you like wonder enough what my tits look like under this top.
I apologize.
That's a very good point.
What does that sentence mean? And who's saying it? Wow.
Because you're then putting all the responsibility on the woman for a man's reaction.
Yes. Yeah. Leaving little to the imagination, her bloody jumper. Yeah. It's like, I'm sorry.
Also, like, why
she's not making this game fun enough. I want to be guessing what her ass looks like. I don't want to be shown. How dare she?
I think this is valid, right? That's a valid point. That's a valid point, Lily Allen. That was a good one.
Yeah. Sorry.
When you had children, did you have to rethink career strategy? Did that feel a natural break?
Well, as I said before, I never really had a strategy when it comes to career. But yes, my children ruined my career.
I mean, I love them and they complete me, but in terms of, like, you know, pop stardom, totally ruined it. Yeah.
That's such a good answer. I'm so happy to hear someone say that. Everyone's like, no, of course not. Does not mix. And really annoys me when people say you can have it all, because quite frankly, you can't. And, you know, some people choose their career over their children and that's their prerogative. But, you know, my parents were quite absent when I was a kid. And I feel like that really left some, like, nasty scars that I'm not willing to, you know, to repeat on mine. And so I chose stepping back and concentrating on them. And I'm glad that I've done that, because I think they're pretty well-rounded people. Fingers fucking crossed.
No, they are bloody peaceful
people.
That's
so true what you said about we are fed this narrative that we can have it all. And, like, I don't have kids, but I couldn't do my job with two children at the moment. Like, the amount of stuff you have to drop.
Listen, I actually think if we weren't so... sort of self-centered as people these days, and I think that, you know, on Instagram you see quite a lot about this you know, no negative energy, and, you know, I'm protecting my healthy boundaries and it's all about me and blah blah blah. I think if we were less like that and we were more actually about the community and taking care of the community, then maybe you could have it all. But I think, in, you know, people just can't afford childcare in the way that you're supposed to. I mean, it just doesn't add up. So you...
childcare thing's a fucking joke, actually.
It's insane.
Unbelievable.
People can barely afford to live without children. So how are you meant to do it with children?
I wonder if we will see more of a knock-on effect on people who would like children, because obviously it's most of the time a choice, not being able to have them, because financially it feels like such a precarious
something has got to give. Because it was hard when I was a kid, and that's like 35 years ago, so I'm not quite sure how my mum would have survived. Like, Playcenter brought me up, and that was a quid a day.
Our parents' generation, like, they were like moved out of home and were like living on their own when they were 22. They're not leaving home until they're like 35.
I read a statistic that most people in the 80s, between the ages of 18 and 30, owned a house, and now most people between 18 and 30 are living at home. Like, in recorded history, this is the biggest period of time.
Of course. People are still living at home. And we were really lucky. We were financially in a really good place when we were in our early 20s, and we got flats and moved out and things like that. But even our mates were moving out.
But hang on, even like in 2008 when the crash happened, but I had the success of my first album, I remember thinking, hang on a second, like I'm number one in the actual charts and like on the front cover of the newspapers every day, and I found it hard to buy myself a flat. I was like, how is everyone else coping?
Yeah.
And it's definitely not got easier. So, so yes, in answer to your question,
they ruined my life. I don't have children.
Well, ladies, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Kenny.
If you enjoyed this episode, you might like to listen to my previous conversation with Mikita Oliver, in which she joined the Radio Times podcast alongside her mother, the broadcaster and chef, Andy Oliver. Thank you for listening to the Radio Times podcast with me, your host, Kellyanne Taylor. Please do follow, rate and review wherever you get your podcast from. It helps other TV and film lovers find us. Until next Tuesday, happy viewing.